Yes, good evening and welcome again. It's a very nice day today, isn't it?
Yes.
Rainy and cloudy. Good day to be speaking about guilt and shame. So as we can see, many people have been registered, but many haven't turned up, I think, perhaps because of the weather. Welcome. Okay, let's begin with some meditation as usual and then we will proceed. I allow the body and the mind to settle down. Letting go of all tension from the muscles of the body. Relaxing my feet, my legs. My stomach, my chest. Relaxing my arms and shoulders. Relaxing the muscles of my neck and face. And as the body relaxes, I turn my attention inwards to the mind, letting go of all thoughts of the past and the future. Withdrawing myself from all experiences of this physical existence, my activities, relationships, bodily sensations, I go deep within myself, deep within to the center of my being, deep within to the soul, the spirit. Experience my entire existence converging, concentrating into a point of light. Like a sparkling star shining in the center of the brain, giving life and consciousness to this body. That energy which was before this body was, that which will be after this body is no more.
the soul, the spirit, the silent witness. Stabilized in this awareness of my eternal self, I take my consciousness beyond this world of matter, beyond the earth, beyond the moon, beyond the sun, beyond the stars. I go beyond space and time. Until I see myself in a world of light. And I see myself in the presence of God. The light of all lights. The ocean of peace. Shining down upon me. Another sparkling star of conscient energy. And I, the eternal spirit, am bathing in this light. Deeper and deeper into the experience of blissful silence. A silence that is healing, nourishing, empowering. Blissful silence. This experience of being beyond. I allow myself to gently return back to this world of matter, back to this room, back to this body, this physical costume. And once again I take my place behind the eyes in the center of the brain. I, the eternal spirit, the silent listening through these ears. Silent and peaceful. At peace with myself. At peace with the world. So, welcome again. Today we have some heavy stuff to speak about. Guilt and shame. In the previous two sessions, we spoke about fear and anxiety, and we spoke about conflicts, right? Fear, anxiety, conflicts. Many people feel they don't need to address the issue of guilt and shame because it's not real, doesn't exist. Anxiety, fear, conflict, these are obvious things. We experience them, don't we? They're obvious. You can't ignore them. They're there in front of us. We experience them, or we see others who experience them. Guilt and shame is something very internal. And perhaps because of that, it is also very, very painful. And when things are very, very painful, the human mind, or the part of the mind that we call the ego, develops a way of dealing with it through a defense mechanism, or through various defense mechanisms. One of the easiest defense mechanisms is forget what you're feeling. Push it out of consciousness. It's repressed. You see? So we believe it's forgotten, but it is there. Today we will speak about this. We will also look at how guilt and shame are perhaps some of the deepest, if not the deepest, negative experiences of the human soul can experience. And how guilt and shame actually, in many ways, are the progenitor or the creator of almost all negative emotions we experience. These are basic negative emotions. They're very, very deep, very, very deep. And perhaps if we are looking at really bringing about a transformation in our lives and progressing spiritually, many of us have that aim, it becomes almost impossible to ignore these two experiences. And these experiences have been spoken about in many, many stories which work as symbols, many, many metaphors, which have captured the imagination of humanity. We speak about them. We narrate these stories again and again and again. We make movies on these stories. We will speak about some of these today. And yet, because the story, the symbol, is a projection of the unconscious. What I am unable to fully experience within me, I create a story out of that. I make symbols out of that. When I make a symbol out of that, it's easier to manage a symbol because it's tangible, it's out there, it's not in here anymore. In this way, symbols and stories and metaphors can also work as defense mechanisms, ego defense mechanisms that try and protect the ego from the experience of anxiety. So it becomes easier to look at these symbols. But it's very, very important for us to look at the meaning of these symbols. What do they mean? And how are they relevant to me? So we will speak about some of these things today. We are, of course, looking at these two emotions. Many people will call them guilt and shame. What is the
difference between these two? Is there a difference between these two? Yes? What do you think? How would you define these two emotions, guilt and shame?
Is there a difference? Yes?
Difference that I think of when I look at the two words is the guilt is the actual feeling experienced, mm-hmm. whereas shame is a resulting feeling out of guilt.
So what you're saying is shame can very often be or is maybe perhaps always connected to guilt or something that emerges from guilt, is what you're saying?
Yeah, that it emerges from guilt as a result of existing guilt.
Yeah, okay. Let's look at this also. We will also look at experiences of shame or what appears to be shame that need not necessarily emerge from an experience of guilt. But of course, there is of course a very deep connection between these two. But what is the experience of guilt and what is the experience of shame? Do we all experience it at some time, guilt and shame? Or these are things we don't experience? We don't experience. There are some anthropologists that speak about guilt cultures and shame cultures. Right? I think it's a bit of generalization. But anyway, you see, in some cultures you have more experience of guilt and people are controlled and society is regulated by guilt. Some cultures, society is regulated by shame. There's some element of truth in that, I suppose. But we experience it everywhere in the world, don't we? Guilt and shame. So what is the experience of guilt and shame? What is guilt? Very common, I feel guilty, I'm guilty, I'm feeling so guilty. I see someone cleaning, I'm feeling very guilty, let me help you. Yes, you were saying something?
It's about the responsibility. Mm-hmm. The responsibility. I don't have to feel shameful about it.
Oh, what is guilt? Guilt is responsibility or?
A part of it.
Okay, so what you're saying, if I've understood you correctly, is that guilt comes from a responsibility.
Feeling of responsibility.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Yes, go.
Comes from not living up to expectations.
Not living up to some expectations. What would be the difference between guilt and shame then? You were saying something?
Yeah, it's when you are not doing something you think you should do.
Expectation, not doing something you believe you should do. There is an element of should. I should be doing this or I should not be doing this, and when in some way I sort of violate those standards, there is some experience which we call guilt. I have not done what I... Anything else? Any other experience?
I think it's, isn't it, when you go against your own values?
We go against certain values, certain standards. It could be in terms of I believe I should be doing this and I don't. So I have certain standards in mind. There is a violation of those standards and that leads to the experience of guilt. Anything else? Yep.
Something, do something wrong, you regret.
Yeah, we do something wrong. Again, there are certain standards, certain values, and our sense of wrong is connected with those standards and values. And so we experience guilt. Yes?
I would say that sometimes it's also given to us. Guilt. Mm.
Interesting. How do you mean?
Because if you take a child and the child drops something and the parent gets angry, the feeling of the child is guilt. Mm. And it's not the child who's done something wrong, but the parent's reaction makes it.
So we also learn this experience, this emotion of guilt through certain experiences we've had. And we will look at that as well. Anything else? What about shame? How will we differentiate guilt and shame? These are very interesting, very deeply, like anxiety and fear. We spoke about anxiety and fear in the first talk we had this season. And we spoke about how they're also very closely related, but and yet they're different experiences. And both can coexist. What about shame? What is shame?
Yeah. I think that, for me, the difference is that guilt usually comes from other people's expectations, and shame comes from your own expectations.
Okay. Yeah. Some argue the other way around.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes, they do. Some say actually that guilt comes more from internal standards, and shame more from external standards, and then some say the other way, and some say basically it can work both ways. Guilt and shame can come both from internal and external standards. So we will look at that, of course. We will look at these standards. Any other thoughts on shame? some countries have a political philosophy of a shame campaign. You know that?
Mm-hmm.
Many countries. Someone has done something wrong, then there are some systems that the law, certain steps that the law takes that ensure that the person lives under shame. For example, I think in the United States, in some states at least, people who have been accused and who have been found guilty of pedophilia, they have a label put up on their cars, on their home: "I am a pedophile." You know? And that for some time they have to do that. It's a many would say you can't do something like that, but it is done. In many other countries, people use. In another country, I remember there was a campaign where some people, a certain community was found, was accused of dealing with a lot of drugs. And so the justice of the country, the Trooper Law Police, went and painted that area red. All the houses where these people lived were painted red, streaks of red. And it was publicized in the papers about why it was done. You know, this is all good. So in some ways, society tries to regulate the behavior of its members through such shame campaigns. But anyway, what is the experience of shame? Yes? Any thoughts? We will try and differentiate between these two feelings based on whatever little bit of research has been done in this area. There has been some interesting research done. So we will look at it a little bit psychologically initially, and then we will move towards a spiritual dimension. Generally speaking, when we speak about guilt and shame, this is the way people normally they differentiate. So guilt is more related to the act. There is an act I have performed, which is a violation of certain standards. So there is, of course, this experience of violation of, say, certain standards. What these standards are, we will, of course, look at this a little later. So then there is the act. When we come to the experience of shame, the understanding is that it is more the whole person. In some ways, this is said to be more specific, and this is sort of a more generalized experience. So I performed an act that is wrong, according to whatever standards I have in my mind. I hit someone, say, I feel guilty. And so the act, I am guilty for that act. It's also in the New Testament, they speak about guilt. What is that? It is something. There's a very nice statement. Deserving of judgment, something like that. You're being judged for an act that is against certain standards, which is very often called in religious terminology sin. Right? There is a sin that has been performed. A sin is a movement away from certain standards, and the person is guilty. And therefore, the person has to be punished. In most serious forms, the person has to burn in the fire of hell. Right? So there is a sin. That is the understanding. But anyway, there is some act for which a person feels culpable. I'm the culprit, I should not have done this. It's a violation of the standards. When this feeling gets generalized to the whole person, then there is the experience of shame. So here, for example, I deserve punishment. I am a sinner, I deserve punishment. And going by the classic understanding of sin and guilt and all that. But generally, the understanding or the feeling inside the soul that I deserve punishment, I've done something wrong and I deserve punishment. And when we come to the experience of shame, it's a lot more, in some ways, it's deeper, more generalized, something like the experience of, I can't look at myself. There is the experience of having done wrong. There is the experience of being unworthy. I've lost all worth as a person, as an individual. And if you look at pictures and paintings and sculptures that try and depict guilt and shame, you will find some very interesting differences.
Guilt is like a person covering themselves up or turning away, you know, not wanting to be looked at, not wanting to look at the self. Downcast eyes, can't look into the eyes, for example. This experience of guilt that has been transformed into shame. Does it make sense? Some sort of a difference, but of course we know they're very, very deeply connected. And so, this experience that we will, of course, speak quite a bit about today, the experience of guilt and shame. Can you tell us one very famous story that captures the essence of guilt and shame? Ancient story. We have been speaking about it again and again. Yes?
The Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Eden and the fall of Adam and Eve. Right? Classical symbol of guilt and shame and the metaphor of the fall. The fall from grace. So what's the story? Let's go back to that story. Now we're all in this modern world, yet we keep speaking about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. Of course, it's all fantasy and out there, right? It's very, very convenient to be out there. But if you look at it, what's the story? So Adam and Eve were created, whatever it is, and then they were given this beautiful garden to do, you know, and enjoy and be very nice and everything. Anyway, there's a tree in the garden that they're not supposed to go near. And then Satan lures Eve. The women are always responsible, of course. So Satan, in the form of the serpent, lures Eve and gives her the apple. You know the story. She eats the apple, and then that's not enough. She has to give it to Adam, corrupt the man, basically. All women corrupt men, apparently. So then she corrupts the man. And then, of course, what do they do after they've eaten the apple?
They start covering themselves.
They start covering themselves with leaves. The guilt and then the shame. You hide yourself. You want to hide yourself. Hide yourself from the world. Hide yourself perhaps from your own eyes, your inner moral eyes. And then, of course, our old man upstairs, God, he comes and he gets very angry at them. See, God gets angry like all of us do. And so he throws them out of, casts them out of the Garden of Eden. They come upon this little earth that we have, if you call our home. So the fall of Adam and Eve. The symbol of Adam and Eve and the metaphor of the fall. So what is this fall? What does guilt and shame? Now, of course, we look at it as a symbol. And we understand it as a reflection of the experience of guilt and shame. So in the story, we see there are certain standards that have been created. In the story, it is shown as God created certain laws, certain standards. Depicted here as a tree and an apple that you should not eat. Yeah. But it's that's one other story. But there are certain standards, created, not created, internal, we will look at them later. And then, until we follow these standards, we are living in happiness, in grace, in heaven. We go against these standards, we fall. We feel guilt, feel shame. And so what is this experience of the fall? Psychologically, we understand the loss of self-respect. You lose your self-respect. You fall in your own eyes and perhaps in the eyes of others. So, there is the guilt and the shame. And we are looking, of course, at the loss of self-respect, in other words, the fall. That's the story of Adam and Eve. Coming back to our own lives and our own experience of guilt and shame. So when we experience guilt, we experience shame. Do we experience simultaneously a lot of respect for the self? You don't, I mean, that somehow doesn't go together. Anyone? No? Some of you? No? So what do we do then? We will look at that later. There are many ways that we try and deal with that, consciously or unconsciously. But what are these standards that we try and follow in the first place? You spoke about these standards that we've taken from the world, right? So what are these standards that we are trying to follow? What are these standards that when we violate, we experience this guilt and this shame and then therefore the consequent loss of self-respect? Where do these standards come from? So you spoke about how a child is growing up and the child is learning certain standards of behavior. right? The mother has scolded the child for something, and so the child feels, oh, I'm guilty, I've done something wrong, right? Many times when a couple is getting divorced, children blame it on themselves. They feel they are guilty. They've done something wrong. Mommy and daddy are getting divorced because I've done something wrong. No? Children are children. Their cognitive capabilities have not developed so much, and unless and until they are dealt with, they carry these things within them. So anyway, then the experience of shame, we were speaking about guilt leading to the experience of shame. Can there be shame without really any experience of guilt?
In contexts where an individual that is being affected by shame might have had some sort of negative reinforcement by what his life was like. And the guilt has not internalized from the individual, but from the society, and he's experiencing shame as a result.
So for example, so we are looking here at one of the standards, and one of these standards that we look at are, of course, these external sociocultural standards, where very often people speak about this loss of face, some sort of recognition or lack of recognition by the world around us. So for example, in some countries that I have visited, some people would say, like, we have these talks and we have these meditation courses in the center, for example, in the Raja Yoga centers. And in some countries, even some countries in the Western world, some countries in the Eastern world, people register for the, say, for the course, and they walk in to the course, and they are the only person in the room. They feel uncomfortable. They look around, no one else has come. What's happening? Should I be here? And there are certain dynamics that kick in there. And when we investigate, when you speak and you try and discover what is happening, what is happening? What do you think is happening in such cases?
Feeling shallow.
Yes, and why?
Because not everybody is doing it.
So?
But you expected something else, expected to that there would be people there.
Yeah, but why?
Because they don't trust in themselves.
That is true. But why is it? What is happening there? Yeah?
It's some sort of, it's like conforming, isn't it? Because we are maybe unconsciously used to conforming, some sort of conformity. And it's one of those situations where you just doubt yourself because the majority influence is absent.
Am I doing the right thing? Of course, there could be many explanations to that, but one explanation certainly is the experience of how is the world going to look at me? This silly man coming all alone to this place? Is it a strange place? Is it a cult? Is it a sect? Do I want to be associated with this place? What will people think if they see me walking into this door? Now, there is no guilt there because I've not done anything wrong as such. But there could be this experience of loss of face and a sense of shame. I don't want to be seen walking into the center.
What the people are thinking about me.
Exactly, what are they thinking about?
If I can meet somebody that knows me, what?
Coming here?
Coming here?
What? So there can be this experience. It can come out in very interesting and funny ways. For example, I shop at Irma. I can't be seen shopping at Aldi. Or I'll do it when no one's looking, maybe. And going and shopping in a small little shop run by some funny people? I can't do that. Yeah? The experience of shame. It's quite pervasive. We find it in many, many aspects of our daily life. It is there. This is the experience of shame. I want to hide myself. I want to make sure no one sees me there.
Yeah.
Right? So, for example, Denmark was one of the first countries to have legalized pornography, right? Legalized pornography. And so going into a pornographic shop and buying things and all these things, is people do it. In another country, you wouldn't want to be seen doing it because the social standards are very different. So there are some rules people follow because the social norms, social standards of what is right and what is wrong are very different in different places.
Now, social standards, are they right? Are they wrong? Which social standard is right and wrong? That's a never-ending debate, and we will not get into that, right? Because that, there's no point in of that. We're looking at the experience of shame. So in this situation, we can actually see this experience of shame manifesting itself, but not necessarily through the feeling of having done something wrong, having sort of crossed the line internally, but you still experience it, and you want to sort of show face and present yourself in a certain way. So that's one. Then you were speaking about the other aspect of the experience of guilt and shame, where I am internalizing certain standards. And in a psychological whatever terminology, we speak about these as introjected standards. These appear to be internal. They are in many ways internal. But they are not really internal because they are taken in from the world outside. So, for example, the child who learns that to break a thing is wrong and gets punished. So the child learns to break something is wrong and therefore the child is guilty. The child grows up with this understanding and that experience becomes unconscious. But the effect of that experience is still there. And so every time I do something wrong, I break something, I'm feeling guilty. And so we can actually create guilt in this way, through these introjective standards. I'll give you a story of a very interesting case. This girl, she had this compulsion, and one of the ways in which these kind of standards are reflected are in the form of compulsions. This girl had a compulsion to keep her room very clean. Now, it's good to keep your room clean, right? Nice. We all like cleanliness, at least most of us do, and we would like to keep our place clean. Now she had this, but she had this compulsive behavior of having everything clean, everything has to be in order, and then periodically what used to happen, invariably, after a few weeks, the room would become a mess. And she would spend a couple of days feeling guilty and feeling depressed. And then she said, I have to clean. And she would be like lying on the bed and thinking, I have to clean. And she wouldn't clean. Eventually she would muster some energy and she would clean up and she would feel good about herself. Again, after a few weeks, same story. Right? And then some interesting things we discovered. Her natural way of being, her natural personality is actually quite relaxed and flexible. And so she would also like to keep her room not untidy, but relaxed and flexible. However, when she was growing up, her mother was a strict disciplinarian. She loved her a lot, but she was also very, very structured. A pen has to be kept this way, not this way. It has to be this way on the table. Something has to be kept exactly there. Not like this. It has to be in that particular order. She taught this child that. So whenever the child would do those things in that exact way, she would get appreciation from the mother. The moment the pen would be like this instead of like this, why is it like this? You know, it should be like this. She learns these standards. But they're not really her internal standards. She's taking them in, and these are sort of introjected because of the recognition and the love and the affection she's getting from her mother. So she grows up, she's forgotten many of those experiences, but the effect remains. And so she's compelled to do things in a certain way, and she feels guilty when she's not doing them. These are introjected standards that we take in. So they appear to be my standards, but they're not really mine because I'm not working from a space from within. Now, this can happen even later on in life. So, for example, I want to lead a spiritual life. So I want to meditate every day. I want to wake up in the morning and meditate at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, whatever it is. In the center, we have this practice of waking up in the morning at 4 o'clock. So people say, what do you do? You just sit and look. I said, yeah, that's actually what we do because we practice meditation with our eyes open, right? So we sit and look. That's very strange. So now, I have learned that that's the thing to do. This can also become introjected when I find that a compulsion. So every night, I say, I have to wake up in the morning. And in the morning, I don't wake up. Then I feel guilty because I did not do what was right. You see? But the right that I have understood has been imposed upon myself because of certain assumptions I'm carrying inside me. And so therefore, it never comes into reality. If it comes into reality for some time, it is not sustainable because I haven't really done the hard work of looking at what is it that I really, 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 really want to do. It may be true that I may actually, like for example, we all want to keep our rooms clean. It is something we want to do. But am I being controlled? Am I being controlled by my inner desire and yearning? Or am I being controlled by these introjected standards that I have taken in within me? And so the desire to keep my room clean can be motivated by these two forces. Which motivation am I giving him to? So we have, of course, the internal introjected standards. And then, of course, we have what we speak about as our deep spiritual standards. And of course, the experience of compromising on those standards is very, very deep. This is existential. And this is perhaps the most painful violation of standards. And very often we are not aware of it because it is too painful. The understanding that we have in whatever spiritual practices that we speak about is unless and until we are really aware of the deep spiritual standards of the self, it is quite difficult to conquer the experiences of guilt and shame because we keep following compulsions, and because they are compulsions, we cannot always follow them because compulsions create a lot of stress. We feel strained, we feel depleted of energy. After some time, we give up. Then you end up feeling guilty. Then you're compelled to do it again. Then you give up, and the whole cycle repeats. What do we mean by these deep spiritual standards? Are we even aware of our inner standards is a question. And if we are not, then it has major implications. Many of us might have had some experiences. My favorite example to illustrate this point is a story. I have shared it with some of you before. But I think it's probably the best example that I can think of. This is of a person I know very, very well. So if you look at his standards were very, very, he was brought up in a very modern family, very, you know, also well-to-do family. So all facilities were available, very, very modern, not religious at all. And he was very, very successful, young, attractive, successful, all these things that make people happy, at least for some time. So he was that, and he had a very nice job with a multinational company, traveling all around the world, and he was one of these people who believed in work hard, party harder. You know? So that's how he lived his life, and he was very happy. Now you look at him, he was very, very happy, happy guy. Always smiling and laughing and cheerful and charming and all that. So he goes to Paris one day, in one of his tours. And he's going sightseeing in Paris. And by the way, I must tell you, he's not from a Christian background because what happens is something to do with a Christian symbol. But he's not from a Christian background. So he goes visiting a church. And in this church, he comes across a painting of Jesus sitting down. And Jesus is surrounded by a few women. And he's sort of looking at them, but sort of not looking at them. That kind of expression on his face. And so he somehow got pulled towards this picture. He goes up to this picture and he's looking at this picture. And he sees this figure of Jesus sitting there, very calm, peaceful look on his face. And these women around, very beautiful women, physically very, very beautiful women. But it was as though Jesus didn't care a farthing how beautiful or pretty they were. He was sort of looking at them, but he was looking beyond them. And yet there was a lot of kindness and love in his face. And he was sort of transfixed by that expression. And he started crying. And he started crying and crying and crying. And real crying, sobs of suffering, deep suffering. You know how when you really, really suffer, how people cry. From deep inside and loudly. Everybody in the church is looking at him. So then he feels shame, right? But whatever it is, everybody is looking at him. And he wants to stop, he can't stop. Then he gets out of the church, he goes and sits in the garden outside, and he keeps crying for about half an hour. And he doesn't know what's happening. And he can feel the suffering flowing out from him, coming out. So if it had been someone who had been brought up in a Christian background, he would have said, oh, that's introjected regulation, you know. The guy has been taught that is how he should be, And because he is not like that, therefore he is, you could say that, but he was not. He was brought up in a Hindu background. Absolutely no relationship with Jesus or Christianity. Not even in a very conventional background where people speak about morality and all that. Very, very liberal. Right? What happened to him? Where did all that suffering come from? Of course, that was a big wake-up call for him. Because then he started looking at himself and saying, how did this happen? How could this happen? He was not a guy who was used to losing control. He was always in control, you know, of himself, of his employees, of everyone. And now he totally loses control. He sort of started reflecting. He started meditating after that. And he started having some interesting experiences. And what he felt was the realization at that point in time, and he spent many months on this, finding out what triggered that, emotion. And what he realized, at least what he told me, was this, that, you know, when I saw the look on that face, my feeling was, my immediate thought was, what have I done to myself? What have I done to myself? Have I gone so far from who I am? And see, this happened when he was around 26, 27, I think he was young, and never had had the experience before. So sometimes we may have all had these experiences. Something triggers emotions. Something brings out suffering. Suddenly we feel really, really low and sad and empty. Do we spend time finding out what is really happening? Because that's the voice of the soul. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, always spoke about it in this way. That's the voice of the soul. When you suddenly feel this great darkness, this great emptiness descending upon you, and you feel lonely and sad, that's the voice of the soul. Are you listening to it? And are you spending time trying to find out what is happening? Otherwise, yeah, it's very easy to escape from it. And this friend of mine, he said, after that, I started observing my reactions. And if someone would have asked me, are you sad? Are you depressed? I would have never said that. But after that day, I recognized that there were always moments when I felt sad and depressed. I just wasn't aware of them. And my instant reaction was, whenever I would feel sad and depressed, escape. How to escape? Go out, meet some friends, play golf, play cricket, you know, watch a movie, listen to some music, go for a job. Divert my attention from that, and which is of course good in the short term, but then it doesn't solve the problem. And so after this experience, he would realize he's watching television, and suddenly he would find this great darkness coming upon him. And his immediate instinct was, okay, let's call up someone. And then he would say, no, I have to attend to this issue. What is happening here? And that's how he worked on himself. But so there could be some very deep standards that we may not be aware of, but yet they are there. And therefore, here we speak about this experience of shame as guilt as existing both at the conscious level as well as at the unconscious level. We may be aware of some of it. We may not be aware of some of it. But how do we know that there is the experience of shame and guilt? Our behaviors, our reactions will show that. For example, you're sitting somewhere and suddenly you take a deep breath, we sigh. Where does that come from? Was it just an ordinary exhalation? Or was it some deep unconscious experience of, I've lost it. I'm not good enough. My life is a mess. I've done something terrible. Where has that response come from? This is where mindfulness comes in. Are we aware of our responses? Are we aware of our reactions and where they are coming from? Because if we are not, then, you know, we can escape and they pile on, and one day they burst. And so the implications, of course, of guilt and shame are very deep. And when we don't pay attention to what is really happening inside, we have, of course, many consequences. One very obvious consequence of guilt is anxiety. So we see the anxiety. We all experience anxiety. Where is the anxiety coming from? Do we spend time trying to figure it out, or are we too busy taking pills and going for a job or speaking to people and trying to get over it? Anxiety is one typical response to the experience of guilt. In most extreme forms, we find this disorder called obsessive-compulsive disorder. You may not know of this very much. Symbolized in the story of Lady Macbeth, Shakespeare's Macbeth, right? So she gets Duncan killed, the King Duncan killed by Macbeth, and then she's washing her hands. She wakes up in the night to wash her hands, and she says, "Out, out, damn spot!" The blood on her hands. There's blood on her hands, right? The experience of guilt. A lot of obsessive compulsive behaviors would come from that. This ritual of cleaning. Some people go into extremes: wash, wash, wash. The hands are bleeding, and they still wash. Or locking, checking, or cleaning. Two basic rituals. But one manifestation of getting rid of something. Getting rid of something that I know I have done something wrong. Getting rid of that. That doesn't go. That could be one experience. There could be other experiences, for example. What could be other experiences of guilt? One very interesting research has actually connected guilt to the experience of mania. You know, manic behavior? Going out and spending a lot of money, speaking very loudly, doing all sorts of things like that, very expansive behaviors. There's some very interesting work on that which connects mania to this urge to escape from guilt. So I overcompensate. I try and I overcompensate. The experience of the lack of self-respect that we call the fall. And then when I've lost my self-respect, I certainly want some compensation for it, right? I want to regain it in some way. How do I go about regaining it? I can do it in many, many ways. Some may be constructive, some may not be constructive. But, for example, we have the experience of mania. What could be other responses to the experience of deep anxiety? Or the experience of guilt? Anxiety, mania.
Eating disorders.
Yeah, alcoholism.
Many other things come, of course, that we go into many other issues. There is also some very interesting work connecting guilt to psychopathy. Now, these people are interesting. You know the psychopaths? Generally, the understanding is that they have no experience of remorse. They have no experience of guilt. They don't feel bad about whatever they do. But is that really so? And there is one framework that says that they actually feel so deeply guilty that they just can't confront that guilt. And the implications are very deep. Because the guilt is troubling them inside, they can't confront it. They keep repeating the same actions that have caused that guilt in order to prove to themselves, it's okay, it's not wrong, it's fine, it's okay. It's sort of convincing yourself, I'm actually doing something which is okay. So the desire to escape from that guilt makes us sometimes perform the same actions again and again and again with a childish assumption that it's okay, it's actually fine. Because I have not confronted what I have done. But then the implications become very, very deep. So many of our own self-defeating patterns we can try and look at and try and see where are they coming from. It's like, you know, first time someone does, say, a wrong act, they feel guilty. Do it again, lesser guilty. Third time, even lesser guilty. Many times, you forget the guilt. Have you all had such experiences?
Yes.
Many of us have had these experiences, right? I remember a student of mine, once he said, he was brought up in a very conservative family, right? So he said, I remember once I went out and I watched a pornographic movie, and that's not something that I know my parents would have approved of. And I went back home, I couldn't look my dad in the eyes. And then he said, then I kept doing it, and after some time I could look at my dad in the eyes. So what has happened now? The guilt has gone away? Has the guilt gone away, or has it just gotten suppressed? Something to look at. And where is that guilt coming from? Is it coming from his introjected standards of the father and the mother teaching him what is right and what is wrong? Or is it actually coming from some deeper spiritual standards? This has become very difficult to differentiate. But the practice of meditation becomes critical Because through the practice of meditation, we are expanding awareness and we are trying to find out this difference. This is easy enough to find out. Though many of us are not even aware of that. But this is still very superficial. We can find this out. We can even deal with that. This becomes more tricky. And this becomes really difficult. And separating, creating a separation between what are my inner standards and what are the standards I have taken in from the world, this becomes very tricky. But in my experience, one rule of thumb that works a lot, when I'm following these standards, there is the experience of compulsion. When I'm following these standards, there is no experience of compulsion.
It feels right.
This can also feel right. Oh, this can also feel right. And that's the tricky part. You see? It gives you a kick. Feels right, feels great. I feel great when I, you know, when I do that.
It doesn't last that long,
you're right. That doesn't last that long. And so one way, but again, through the process of meditation, I'm expanding my awareness and I'm trying to include that. Otherwise, then I have all these issues of anxiety and mania and psychopathy, etc., etc., and we can keep adding to that. But then, how is this happening? What are the mechanisms? The way we look at it is, so I lose my self-respect because of these experiences, and then I want some compensation. How do I want compensation? I would like to have compensation by getting some love, getting some respect from others, say, for example, through certain relationships, or say, for example, through certain activities. I want to compensate for this loss of respect by achieving something in this world. I want some compensation. I want some compensation by achieving power, status, wealth, for example, for some people. I want to achieve love and respect for some people. It could be different things. But I want to regain my self-respect. And because I don't know how to deal with the stuff inside me, and I try and I get it from the world outside. As long as I can get it, I'm okay. But if I don't get it, there is the experience of frustration. There is the experience of failure. And when I have failed, it worsens my self-respect. Some people would try to get it through certain roles and positions. They want to hold on to that. But that's my self-respect. A boss in an office, for example. Another person walks in, 2-3 people walk in with a high level of competence. They feel threatened. They want to hold on to that. Where is all this fear and anxiety and insecurity coming from? I want to hold on to these things because I believe through this I will regain my self-respect. But I will not, because the trauma is very deep. And then frustration and failure would, of course, lead to further negative emotions and actions. And when I have further negative emotions and actions, I further lose self-respect. And what could be even more dangerous is, for the purpose of compensating for my lack of self-respect, I can go further against my standards. I go further against my standards. As I go further against my standards, obviously, I feel further negative emotions. So, for example, now I have lost my self-respect. I want to regain it, say, for example, in the case of one person, through a position of power. So when I'm in a position of power, I feel good. I feel I have respect. Right? Situations around me are giving me a signal that I have to let go of that position of power, because perhaps there are other people who can perform that role better than I can at this point in time. But if I let go of that role, I have no experience of self-respect. I want to hold on to that role. And to hold on to that role, I may engage in manipulation. I may engage in discrimination against that person. I may engage in nasty behavior towards that person, spreading bad talk about that person to ensure that person doesn't take that position away from me. Is in no position to take that position away from me. And therefore, what I am doing then is going further against my values in my desire to compensate. And by going further against my values, I'm deepening my negative emotions. and therefore deepening my loss of self-respect, and then I want compensation more, and then it becomes a vicious cycle.
I just wanted to ask, in the process that you outlined, would you say that the element of self-awareness is consistent?
Element of self-awareness is consistent?
Yeah.
I would say it's obviously not.
Yeah.
So every act that is a result of regaining self-respect is all unconscious. So the person is never actually aware of why they're...
Not necessarily. Person can also be aware. There are instances, I know, in my own experience I have seen, sometimes I'm aware.
Yeah.
But the compulsion is so strong.
Yeah, that it overtakes.
It just overtakes. You know, then you don't know. Because you don't know an alternative.
Yeah.
We have not challenged our assumptions of what will give me self-respect. I am so caught up by those assumptions that I don't see any options. So let's go for it. That's the way. That's the world. Everything is fair in love and war. You know, go for it.
Yeah.
But isn't it also because, that we are used to getting it externally and we don't look for it internally?
Exactly. We don't know. We don't have these alternatives that we can use. We don't have alternative frameworks. We have not looked at them. And so what else is there? I mean, we have to do that. And so this can also become not just an individual experience. This can become a group experience, depending on what I identify with. So if a group of people have engaged in an action that they know at some level has violated certain standards, there is the experience of guilt and shame. And these same mechanisms, for example, there can also be projection, there could also be rationalization. So projection, in one way, is you blame the other. The other deserves to be punished. You find this in group dynamics very often. So a country takes over another country, exploits the people, exploits that land, and then they come out. And why did you? But you know, they were barbarians. We went to civilize them. People have given such explanations. They were barbarians. We went to civilize them. We've done them a favor. If we hadn't gone there, what would they have done? They also rationalized. Well, yeah, okay, we did something bad that was not very good, but because we went there, now they have water and they have industry and they have railroads and they have airways and they have all these things. So we can explain. These are also mechanisms that through which groups and individuals try to deal with their guilt and shame, but that doesn't solve anything. So I make weapons, I sell them to poor countries. The poor countries become more problematic because of the weapons I'm selling them, and I feel guilty. Then I go and try and help them. Nice idea, right? Bomb them and then help them. So bomb them, I feel guilty. Then go and help them because I really want to overcome my guilt. How does it solve the problem? Then I keep replicating the lack of awareness. Guilt and shame, as far as I am concerned, has very deep significance for the whole world. Because these are deep, yes?
Maybe because the people, they don't know what is the most important in life.
Yeah.
They are blind. They are not aware of the spiritual life, what is really important. And money, position, everything, okay, it's good for this world, but you can feel very sadness inside, you don't know why. You cannot buy love, happy. You can buy, I'm happy, I'm going shopping, I'm buying shoes, and okay, I think, but when I arrive home, I think by myself, this happens, goes, I have the shoe problem, I had a lot of problems. No, it's something more deeply.
The implications are very deep, and it requires a lot of awareness. It requires awareness at the level of the individual, requires awareness at the level of groups, which we don't have, obviously, in this world.
No.
But we can begin with the level of the self. Looking at shame, also there are some very interesting research connections, the consequences of shame, which are slightly different from the experience of guilt. One is, of course, the experience of depression and withdrawal, which I would suppose would be quite obvious. You want to hide from the world, you don't want to see anyone, don't want anyone to see you, you withdraw from the world. But very interestingly, there is another pattern that has been connected to the experience of shame, and this is narcissism. You know narcissism? People who sort of elevate themselves in some ways, but there are two interesting forms of narcissism. One is this form of narcissism which is grandiose, where the self presents itself to the world for admiration, attention, respect, because the self is hiding inside, actually, the original self is hiding inside in shame. And there is an overcompensation where I'm trying to overcompensate for my inner experience of inferiority and shame by creating this image of myself as this person. And that is what I want to communicate and that I want to get attention from others. That is one way. There is another very interesting spin on narcissism. It is called hypervigilance. Hypervigilance is a different kind. These people don't present themselves in that expansive way that a grandiose narcissist would present himself or herself. So a grandiose narcissist would exaggerate his or her competencies, his or her accomplishments, and sort of, you know, try and get that attention and respect. The hypervigilant narcissist will not do that. But the hypervigilant narcissist would try to engage in behaviors to draw attention. Smiling at people, being nice to people. No, it doesn't mean everybody who's nice is not Now it becomes very tricky. Now it becomes very tricky, right? Then everybody says, oh my God, I can't even smile. This is the problem with psychologists. What to do? So everything has to be diagnosed. That's not fair. But, see, the problem is, we see the external behaviors. We don't really know where they are coming from. And so the same behavior of smiling and being nice can actually come from a very nice, healthy inner space. But it can also come from an experience of this lack of self-respect. And how do we differentiate whether this pattern is there within me also or within others? Their niceness and their smile is not about the other, it's about the self. And how do we know that? Because they are constantly vigilant for signs of rejection. They are oversensitive. They get hurt and upset very easily. And hurt and upset is actually, I'm sorry, but a narcissistic manifestation. Getting rejected. Feeling rejected because someone has not been nice to me. Someone has not smiled at me. And so I engage in behaviors to draw their attention. When they don't get that, I feel rejected. And I feel rejected, then I may engage in certain behaviors. It could also be self-harm in some cases. But in other cases, it could be throwing a tantrum, getting angry at the other, accusing the other of something. It can also turn this way. And when we see these symptoms, then we can clearly see that the connection is narcissistic, which comes from a very low sense of self connected to the experience of shame. And shame is a very generalized sense of self. So maybe many experiences of guilt accumulating over time, over time, over time. And then I feel I've lost my... I'm unworthy. You make me worthy. You make me worthy by giving attention to me. Give me attention, then I feel worthy. You don't give attention, then I don't feel worthy. And when I don't feel worthy, then I can either harm myself or try and harm you. Sorry?
What is
what?
Yeah. I feel what...
Worthy. I feel unworthy, or I feel worthy because you're not worthy. So the implications are very deep. We can go into this for many hours because the consequences are quite deep. So what we see in ourselves and what we see in individuals around us are typically these behaviors. This is what we see. And we condemn people. And we also condemn ourselves when we observe these behaviors. But that doesn't really help. What works in this case then is try and understand where are these behaviors coming from. Because these behaviors emerge, as we understand, from this experience of the lack of self-respect, connected to the experience of guilt and shame, which connects from the violation of certain standards that we are having. So first, that means I have to first understand what these standards are. Simple work. But you know, it can be done.
it can be done. I look at myself and I say, okay, I speak about all these things. To what extent have I really experienced this? And I tell you, it does. Over time, it requires deliberate, consistent practice. Daily, disciplined practice. With time, I begin to be aware of things that I was not aware of before. I begin to be aware of patterns within me that I was not aware of before. All of us have narcissistic tendencies. All of us have that. All of us want some attention. But am I aware of that? And when I'm aware of that, then I know, no, this is, we don't like it. Anyone wants to be narcissistic? No. We don't. That's against the nature of the soul. We don't like that. But because we are unaware, we give in to that. And then we become victims. We let others make us victims. No one makes us a victim, we become victims. I go against standards to get compensation, I'm becoming a victim. So one way of getting compensation is by controlling, regulating, and holding on to things that I believe will give me self-respect. Another way is to give in to others, compromise on your values. Let others use you, let others abuse you, let others manipulate you because you're afraid of losing that relationship, losing that, you know, that companionship which you believe gives you self-respect. And then people can end up being treated as doormats, which further deepens the experience of shame, further deepens our loss of self-respect. Implications are very, very deep. And therefore, the awareness becomes critical. And then acting on that awareness to regain my self-worth, which will come when I can follow the inner standards of the self. Yes? Shall we stop here today? Nice day to speak about guilt and shame. But so what do we do practically? Some suggestions I'll give you today. One is, of course, which, you know, we speak about very often, minimum 1 hour every day for meditation. Less than that is not enough. That's the minimum dosage of the medicine. If possible, 2 hours. Minimum 1 hour. And it's not at a stretch. You can break it up. You can make it very, very easy. 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening, 20 minutes, 10 minutes in the afternoon, 10 minutes again at night. You can break it up. But altogether, 1 hour of meditation. And of course, meditation, those of you who've learned, you've learned. Those of you who have not learned, you're welcome to do a course at the center. You know, we have a Raja Yoga meditation course. Because it's good to go through it systematically. This connection between the soul and God, which we call Raja Yoga, I would encourage you to do it. Those of you who have already learned the course, practice it. 1 hour. And in that process of meditating, ask yourself, what are my inner standards? What are my inner values? Not the stuff I've learned from the world. What are my? Where are my compulsions coming from? And observe yourself throughout the day. Observe the time when you take, when you exhale and when you sigh. What is happening inside? Where is it coming from? Observe the sadness and the darkness and the emptiness that comes in sometimes. And observe yourself trying to escape from that by watching a movie, speaking to a friend, making some food and eating food. That's very nice. Do that. Or going for a jog. Stop yourself. Sit down. Ask yourself, what is happening? Where is this coming from? Go deep into soul consciousness. Connect to God. Become deeply silent. I promise you, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, that experience of emptiness will lift. That's the magic of meditation. It will lift. It will lift because the soul has the capacity. It has the capacity of generating the experience of fullness when it is connected to God. Practice that. When you practice that, you develop faith in it. You know, today I'm here sitting and standing and speaking to you. This morning something happened. Something pretty big happened. And I felt those negative emotions of anxiety and all coming up, right? And I know why it's coming. It's coming because I have become dependent on something outside to regain my self-worth. So that is very clear in my head now after some years of practice. So I know what I need to do. I just need to sit down for 20 minutes, go into deep silence, go beyond this physical world. I am the spiritual self, just a point of light. place myself under the light of God, go into deep silence, within 2 minutes it's gone. Guaranteed. But do it. So let's do it now. Once again, letting go of all thoughts, sensations, and experiences of this physical world. Withdrawing myself from this external world of relationships, activities, experiences. I go deep within myself. Deep within to the center of my being. I experience my entire existence converging into a point. A point of light. A sparkling star. The center of all life and consciousness. The source of all beauty and truth. Silent and peaceful. Experience as though this physical body and this physical world has disappeared. All that remains is light. And I see myself beyond space and time in a world of light. And I see myself once again in the present of God. The supreme light. The ocean of love. The eternal healer. Sparkling star of conscient energy, just like the soul. And I see myself bathing in this light.
absorbing this light into the very depths of my being. Letting this light flow into me. Healing. Purifying. I lose myself in this experience of blissful silence. In this experience of union between the soul and the Supreme. And once again I take my place in the center of the brain, looking out through these eyes, listening through these ears. I, the Eternal Spirit, the being of light, the being my original nature, peace, my only religion. Om Shanti.
Okay, tack för idag.
Tack.